So good afternoon once again. Welcome to those who've just joined us to the Council Chamber of the Royal Statistical Society in London for this meeting of the Journal Club on the topic of publication bias in meta-analysis. We're very grateful to Quintiles for sponsoring this meeting this afternoon. My name is James Carpenter and I'll be chairing the meeting. And our speaker this afternoon is John Kopas, Emeritus Professor of Statistics at the University of Warwick. John's published widely on statistical methodology, presented several red papers to the Society, and is a recipient of the Society's Gold Silver Medal. John has served on the Methodology Advisory Committee at the Office for National Statistics and has worked on many collaborative projects in medicine and the social sciences. Over the last 15 years or so, John's published a number of papers on this afternoon's topic, meta-analysis and publication bias. His presentation this afternoon is based on a paper he published in the first volume of Applied Statistics this year, titled A Likelihood-Based Sensitivity Analysis, a Publication Bias in Meta-Analysis. The slides for this afternoon's presentation are available for download from the Royal Statistical Society's website. If you go to the homepage, you can follow the links to the Journal Club. The session this afternoon, as you've probably already heard, will be recorded, and the recording will be posted on the Journal Club webpage after the meeting. John's presentation will last around 30 minutes, and during this time, all participants will be muted. After the presentation, I'll give a brief comment and ask a couple of questions, after which I'll open the discussion by unmuting everybody. During the discussion, in order to keep background noise to a minimum, please keep your phone muted if you are not actually asking a question. Entering *6 on your phone toggles muting on and off. For participants who are using the web conferencing option, you can type questions as the presentation is proceeding using the Q&A interface. When we finish the presentation, and the club has wrapped up, you're invited to provide feedback using the poll tool. Now, this is not anonymous feedback. Your name and email address will be recorded. Okay, so with those preliminaries out of the way, I'd now like to invite Professor John Kopas to give his presentation.
Well, thank you very much, James. Let me briefly review my paper on publication bias. There are broadly two aims of the paper, I think, which are noted at the top of the second slide. The first aim is to discuss some of the statistical difficulties of publication bias, which I see as essentially a problem of non-random sampling or selective sampling. And the second aim is to develop some theory about selection models appropriate for publication bias and to suggest a sensitivity analysis which perhaps is useful. So in my remarks today, I'll very briefly start off with an introduction, and then I'll talk about the section 2 of the paper, which is a rather notorious example of meta-analysis, which has been a lot discussed, but is appropriate, a motivating example we're going to do. Then I'm going to dip into the centre, more mathematical heart of the paper by reviewing some of the topics there about selection models. So that's scattered between sections 2 and 4 of the paper. I'll then come back to the example of that section 5.1 of the paper and make a few remarks at the end for points of discussion, and these are selected from some of the points in section 5.3 and 6 of the paper. So for my very brief introduction, on the next slide now, all I've done here is to note that meta-analysis can be thought of as involving three rather distinct stages. So first of all, we have the systematic review. So that's a literature search to identify papers or studies or clinical trials, in the case of the example we're talking about, which are relevant to the question of interest. Second stage is each study has a statistical summary defined in a consistent way across the studies. And in medical applications, simplest cases, we're usually interested in some parameter, some treatment effect, or some relative risk. And each paper, we imagine, gives us an estimate of the parameter of interest with its own variance. And then the third part, what would usually be thought of as meta-analysis proper, is how to combine the study summaries into an overall conclusion. And the simplest model one can start off with is the fixed effects model, which simply says that each estimate of this parameter theta is normally distributed around a common a true value for that parameter with its own variance. And if that model is correct, then the maximum likelihood estimate, rather trivially, is simply the weighted average weights inversely with the variance, as one might expect. And the variance of the overall estimate, theta tilde, is just one over the sum of the weights. So let me move now to the example on the fourth slide. So here is the example published in 1993, so 20 years ago. So this is actually a relatively early example of meta-analysis in medicine. And the review had 15 clinical trials, and all were concerned with measuring the effectiveness of magnesium in controlling heart disease. So here theta is the log relative risk, chance of dying on the treatment compared with the chance under control. And so we've got 15 estimates of theta and we've got 15 variances. And using the formula I just mentioned, this gives a relative risk as a whole of 0.58. So that's over a 40% reduction in death rate. So that seems pretty phenomenal. And the top end of the confidence interval, 0.73, is way clear of 1, so it's very highly significant. And it's the kind of p-value I've noted here, which you never quite believe, but that's formally what it is. And the published conclusion from the meta-analysis, in fact it was the title of the article which I mentioned at the top there, magnesium is an effective, safe, simple, and inexpensive intervention that should be introduced into clinical practice without delay. And so that just seemed too good to be true, which is exactly what it was. Because on the next slide, I note that only 2 years later was published the result of ICES 4 trial. So this was a very large, multi-centre randomised controlled clinical trial, and they reported, amongst other things, death rates on magnesium and control. And you notice from those figures there, the number of deaths on magnesium is actually slightly larger than the number on control. So the relative risk is slightly bigger than 1, but not significantly so. And so the conclusion from this large trial, which would normally be regarded as the definitive gold standard here, is that there is no significant difference between magnesium and control, and in fact magnesium may actually be harmful. And so there was a lot of heart searching at the time amongst meta-analysis people who started writing articles with titles like "Can Now Meta-Analysis Be Trusted?" And so there was a lot of scepticism about the whole idea then. Why was this so? Why did this meta-analysis get the answer so dreadfully wrong? Well, it's always a good idea to look at the data. First rule of statistics, I reckon. And here's the funnel plot for the 15 trials. So along the bottom, we've got a theta scale, and up the side, we've got 1 over sigma, and that's just chosen to be roughly a measure of size of the trial. So in this case, there was one reasonably big trial at the top of the graph there, and 14 much smaller trials. And the points plot the estimates, of course, of the individual studies, and the horizontal bars are the confidence intervals, as one might expect. And this is a good example of what people usually call the small study effect. That the 14 small studies pretty clearly tend to give estimates further to the left than the estimate we get from the one reasonably large study. So by the left, of course, means that we've got a stronger treatment effect. Now, why might this be? This is really the thing I'm looking at in the whole paper. So we go on to the next slide. And let's just think now of meta-analysis or systematic reviews as a process of sampling. We end up with a sample, in this case, a sample of 15. And how come that a clinical trial that has been done somewhere actually ends up in the meta-analysis? Well, it has to go through a series of hurdles. The trial has to be written up, has to be submitted for publication, has to be accepted for publication, and has to be found by the reviewer. It has to be in an accessible place. And the conjecture widely held is that studies reporting a significant result, in other words, more interesting studies, if you like, are more likely to survive this ladder of selection than studies which are inconclusive or just simply underpowered. And so if this conjecture is true, then the studies we end up with in the systematic review are not going to be like a random sample of the ones we start with. They're going to be biased, and that is the publication bias I'm discussing. So a little more formally then, perhaps we can go on to the next slide, can we? Let's put this into a little more formal framework. So let's imagine the studies that have been done on a particular area of interest form a population, and it's just a bivariate population, theta hat and sigma squared. Are the data, of course, for each study. And from this population, we're going to end up with a sample in the systematic review. And the conjecture I mentioned in the last slide is that the probability that a study is selected, gets through this process, is going to depend on its significance. And in this case, that will be just a dependence on the t-statistic, the ratio of theta hat to sigma. So a model which encapsulates the conjecture is that the probability that a study with theta hat and sigma squared is selected is going to be some function of y. I use y because y is the vertical coordinate of the radial plot, rather than using t, which might be less confusing, but I call it y. Now, of course, we don't really know what this function A is. It could be, for example, AY could be 1 everywhere for all Y. In that case, there is no bias because all the studies get selected. On the other hand, the most extreme case might be that we have some threshold of significance involved, and we accept all the studies one side of that threshold and reject all studies the other side. The truth probably lies somewhere between those two extremes. So can we go on to the next slide? Well, what we don't really know what A is, but what can we say about this process? Well, under the null hypothesis, when theta is naught, then defined as theta hat over sigma is clearly has a standard normal distribution under the fixed-effect model. So under the null hypothesis then, the marginal probability of selection, which I'm going to call P from now on, is just the expectation of AY under the standard normal distribution phi Y. So that's that integral there. And by Bayes' theorem, the expected value of Y, given that a study has been selected, is given by that expression which you can see down there. And I call that mu. But theta hat is just Y times sigma. So this means that the expectation of theta hat under the null hypothesis, given that the study has been selected, is mu times sigma, which we can think of as mu divided by 1 over sigma. But 1 over sigma is just the vertical axis of the funnel plot. So this is, in fact, a curve of expected values we can superimpose on the funnel plot. And in fact, it's a hyperbole because of the delusion. So if we go on to the next slide. I've just copied down exactly the same funnel plot as we had before, but I've now superimposed on that the curve of the expected values of theta hat for the studies we have selected. Now, the different curves, of course, correspond to different values of mu. We don't really know what mu is, but the point to note is that those curves seem to point up exactly the kind of skewness or small side effect that we have observed in the data. So it's a kind of promising candidate, as it were, for thinking about what's going on. So we can go on to the next slide now. I'm jumping slightly because section 3 of the paper generalizes this argument about the fitted values and P, generalizes it to all values of theta, and also generalizes it to the random effects model, which is the one that's usually used in practice. And section 4 of the paper then develops an example, which is the one I've flagged up now in slide number 11. So here we have the random effects model, and this is an example of a function A. And the idea is that we want a function which is kind of intermediate between the two extremes I mentioned. And a plausible candidate for that would be a logistic function. Now, for purely mathematical reasons, I use a probit regression instead, but practically it's more or less the same. So AY now is capital phi, the standard normal distribution function, of alpha plus beta y, or alpha plus beta theta hat divided by sigma. And the rest of that slide just flags up what happens if you apply the theory developed in section 3 on this particular example, and you get an expression for P, for example. So this is the marginal probability of selection, and it's this expression there. And we now have a parametric model, fully parametric model, and so we have a likelihood function, and the log likelihood is the thing I've written down there. And these are all easy things to code up in practice. And so having written down an explicit likelihood function, you might say, well, hey presto, we can now just go and fit this as we normally would from likelihood functions. But we need to pause, and the next slide points out that there is a very substantial statistical difficulty. And the difficulty is that the available data, which is just the funnel plot essentially, usually gives very little information about the value of P. In other words, the overall proportion of studies which are selected. I'm going to say a little bit more about that later. So what I suggest is not actually an overall fit of this model, but a sensitivity analysis. And this quantity P is a thing which is really very hard to track down from the data. So the sensitivity analysis fixes the value of P, so it suggests, and finds the corresponding maximum likelihood estimates of the other parameters consistent with that particular value of P. And then the sensitivity analysis is simply two graphs. One, the first one is you can plot the confidence interval for theta against P. And the second one is you can do this expected value calculations I did before in a simpler case. And you can superimpose the fitted value curves on the funnel plot. And we can do this for any value P that we care to choose. Next slide just looks a little bit more detail about how you actually do this. So for any given value of P, we get the likelihood function for the orthogonal complement of the parameters, as it were, and we can get the maximum likelihood estimate theta hat sub P, and we can also have the likelihood function L sub P, say, and we can just use the standard chi-squared approximation of log likelihood ratio to get the confidence limits. And for the second plot, we need to have the expected values. Well, that's the expression for the fitted values of the funnel plot, which is derived using the theory in section 3 again. Lambda is the Mills ratio for the normal distribution. So next slide just shows you what happens if you do this. So this is the sensitivity plot for the magnesium study that I was talking about earlier. So looking at the right hand end of the plot, when p is 1, p is the scale along the bottom, of course, and up the side is just the scale of theta. So the centre line, these are the estimates, and the lower and upper line, these are the upper and lower, the other way around, confidence limits calculated in the way I've indicated. So for p equals 1, we get the estimates and the confidence interval comfortably below the null line of 0, so that corresponds to the highly significant result I noted before. The fact that we're using random effects now when p is 1 doesn't actually make very much difference. But you can now see what happens as we allow for a greater degree of selection to come into this procedure. So as p decreases from 1, we move to the left in the graph, and all these lines go upwards. So in other words, you end up with less extreme less extreme inferences for the treatment effect. And the one that goes up particularly fast, as you might expect, is the top confidence limit. And you notice that the top line crosses the null zero at about p equals 0.6. So that suggests, for what it's worth, if this model is literally correct, of course, that suggests that if p is less than about 0.6, then the treatment effect is no longer significant. And for the other plot on the next slide, so again I've taken the funnel plot again, and I've now superimposed the expected value lines. They look very like the curves we had before, but displaced a little bit. And I've plotted the fitted values for p equals 1, 0.9, 0.5, 0.1. P equals 1, well, that's just the vertical line because there's no selection going on at all. And the vertical line there, solid line, is at the random effects estimate of theta in p equals 1. But as p gets smaller, then this line gets more and more sloped and gets more skewed. So when it's 0.9, it moves a little bit to the right at the top, but rather more to the left at the bottom, and so on. And you note that the time you get to the third line, across from the left there, so that's 0.5, we notice that that curve goes through all of those individual confidence intervals. So p equals 0.5 is consistent in that sense with all of the individual clinical trials. Now let me come back a little bit on the next slide now to this central question of this statistical difficulty of estimating p. From the data. So you might say, well, why do we do the sensitivity analysis, which essentially fixes p and therefore ignores all information about p in the data? Why don't we use all the information we've got? So that's the first question we might ask. And the second one is, why don't we just take this selection model, or by the way, a number of other selection models that have been suggested elsewhere in the literature, and just use it to find the maximum likelihood estimate of theta in the normal way. And I'll just give you two examples of what happens if you do these two things. So the next slide, this is a typical log likelihood function, the maximized profile log likelihood function for p, using the selection model I've suggested. Actually, this is for the second example in the paper, as I'm not supposed to put both in the paper, but the other one actually looks rather similar. So here we have the profile likelihood of p. The maximum likelihood estimate of p is about 0.6, which seems probably pretty sensible. And of course it falls off each side. But if you look at the vertical coordinate there, you see that the scale is really rather fine. So this likelihood function actually is extremely flat. So although on the face of it, it seems to be pointing to 0.6, actually the data tells you almost nothing about the value of p. And the second question in the next slide, just to have a different model in mind, I've gone to the paper by Carol Preston and colleagues in 2004, and I've used their selection model, or at least one of them, to find the profile likelihood for theta. for the magnesium data again, and there it is. So the maximum is a bit less than zero, and in fact it's pretty consistent with the sensitivity estimate I got when P was about 0.3, so maybe this is not too unreasonable. But to get the confidence intervals, you're in real trouble, because the to get a confidence interval, even under the ideal asymptotic case, you have to go down about 2 units on this model likelihood. So the 2-unit interval is indicated down there. So the confidence interval goes from about -1, this is on the log scale, up to about +5. So it really tells you, again, all there's nothing about things. To quibble about whether it's -0.3 or -0.2 is absurd when you have this enormous range of uncertainty. So going on to the next slide now, let me conclude just by a few comments. Most of these I talked about at some point in the paper. Many meta-analyses suffer from publication bias, arguably all. But this is almost always ignored in practice. Publication bias usually means that the treatment effect is exaggerated. So it's going exactly in the direction you should worry about. It is impossible to adjust for publication bias unless we make untestable assumptions. And that's a very important comment, which underlines much of what is in the paper. So, for example, the AY function I had, we cannot, it's impossible to test that because we don't observe the studies. We don't see, obviously. So it's a missing data problem. So we really can't say anything about why things are selective or why they are not. It is a conjecture, and I've tried to emphasize that throughout. It is a conjecture. The sensitivity analysis conditions on an interpretable parameter because it conditions on P. And the advantage of that is it's something you can think about, something that means something in practice. Whereas many sensitivity analyses suggested in the literature condition on rather obscure parameters in some model somewhere, which on the face of it don't really mean anything at all outside esoteric mathematical circle, as it were. Sensitivity analysis tends to be more robust to modelling assumptions than bias correction methods, and that's another important point, which I do talk about in section 6 of the paper. So, a few summary points about the magnesium example then. Standard meta-analysis gives a strongly significant and strongly misleading result. There's evidence of a small study effect. Smaller studies tend to give stronger treatment effects than one reasonably large study in this case, and that is often seen. Selection models explain the funnel plot trend. For example, when P was 0.5, the fitted values went through all of the confidence intervals, so it seemed to be a reasonable explanation. You can't prove that it's the correct one, of course. The treatment effect is no longer significant if P is less than about 0.6. In the sensitivity analysis. And another way of saying that is the evidence for magnesium in this case would probably remain significant, provided there's only a handful of missing studies. But if the number of missing studies gets into double digits, then a good deal of caution is required in interpreting these results. And the final slide just gives a reference for the three papers I've mentioned in these slides. There's a much longer list of references, of course, in the paper itself. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, John. I'd like to thank you for a very clear and stimulating presentation. So the way we'll proceed now is that I'm going to make a couple of comments and then ask a question, and then I'm going to unmute everybody who's on the call, and there'll be an opportunity for people to ask questions. And I would remind you that when you're not asking a question, if you could mute yourself, then that helps keep the hiss down on the call for the remaining participants. So as a person who spent some time getting to grips with programming the precursor to this model, described in a paper by Kopass and Shi, I can certainly testify that the simplification arising from focusing on selection as a function of theta over sigma and then maximizing the conditional likelihood given p is both theoretically elegant and much more practical in terms of explaining to people what the analysis means. I guess I've got a couple of initial questions, and the first one arises from tribulations programming the previous model, and that's to what extent in examples do you think the estimation difficulties have been avoided? Both of the examples you looked at in the paper had quite a reasonable number of studies in them, but I guess from memory that the median number of studies in the meta-analysis is around 7. Mm. So we've saved one parameter relative to the Hopus and Shi model.
Mm. 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 Yeah, yes, very good question. just a slightly more generally to start with, I see a key practical issue in this whole area is to try and compromise between methods which are relatively easy to implement and easy to understand with methods that are actually statistically sound. That was one a big motivation, in fact, why I started off writing this paper here. I realised that this Cope and Shi method was just far too complicated. So this is much simpler. And numerically, I mean, James, in your work, you pointed out there were numerical problems in about 20% of the study, was it something like that? The numerical problems with this method are not completely disappeared, but they are much, much better than the... it's because it's a much tighter model that the key difference between the models of the two approaches is that the Copus and Shi method does bring in the standard deviation sigma as a key driver in publication, and that soaks up a lot of the information in the final plot.
Yeah.
So you have very close confounding between dependence on sigma and the skewness in the final plot, and all this is much, much worse because of random effects. So the random effect, of course, may go anywhere. Whereas this present paper is much tighter. This says every paper has to follow. This has to go through with this exactly the same selection function. So if you have, just to make it seem absurd, actually, in the face of, if you had an extremely large study and a very small tiddly study, the t value for that is the only thing that matters. Mm. So if you saw that an enormously large study had a t of 1.3 or something, you shouldn't ask how big that study was, and that seems pretty dark in the face of it, doesn't it? So clearly we're making a very strong assumption. And I think it's pretty questionable if you have a very, very large range of study sizes.
Yeah.
Now, often in meta-analysis, most studies are much, much less in size, so that arguably doesn't matter. But it is this compromise between numerical ease and interpretability. And I suppose the other motivation, practical motivation behind the paper was the Copus and Shi method essentially conditions on the two parameters that they're called out from notation I use that. Excuse me, but what on earth are alpha and beta? You know, to understand alpha and beta, you have to really get into the mathematics of it.
Yeah.
Whereas everybody can understand what P is. It's just the proportion of the papers you actually manage to find in your literature. So it's much more interpretable.
Yeah.
And arguably, that is even more important.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether I answered your question.
No, I'm certainly encouraged to go and try it on some of those data sets we looked at before.
Please do.
A second question, I guess, is that there's now a substantial literature in this area. We've got tests for publication bias. We've got methods for bounding effect sizes in the event of publication bias. We've got bias-corrected estimates. We've got sensitivity analyses. Faced with a meta-analysis, What's the most sensible strategy to adopt in practice? Which methods should one reach for, and when, do you think?
Well, I think, yes.
It's a rather tricky question.
I'm sorry you asked this question. I think this is a $64,000 question, isn't it? And you're expecting me to stand to sit down in my throne at some point, God, adjudicating on what is a rapidly and very dispersed literature. I think the truth is there are statistical difficulties with all of these methods, including the one I'm suggesting today, of course. And the difficulties behind them, I think I've indicated in my comments, that you can't do any of these things without untestable assumptions. Now, the simplest methods are funnel plot methods, essentially based on a strong idea of symmetry. Mm. So if you really believe that your funnel plot should be symmetrical, then you monkey about with the points, essentially, and that's a trivial idea, isn't it? Or the other way of doing it, if you think of the radial plot, which is another way I like looking at meta-analysis data, the t-statistic up the vertical axis, that should have a symmetrical distribution. That's the corresponding assumption to the funnel plot one. That should have a symmetrical distribution above the common line. Yeah. And so if you use some argument that's going to locate a line in some symmetrical center, then that seems very appealing. Yeah. That is likely to fail, and it's depending very heavily on symmetry. But wait a minute, there are a lot of problems here, aren't there? So you choose usually pretty arbitrarily which parameter you estimate.
Yeah.
You know, do you use arc sine as one of the things you were told, wasn't it?
Looks like that, yeah.
And that has some big advantages about it, of course. Or do you use log odds?
Yeah.
Or risk differences, whatever. Yeah. So there are lots of different things you might do. And if you have a strictly symmetrical distribution on one, you certainly do not on the other. Any of the other things. Mm-hmm. So which measure we use in practice is pretty arbitrary.
Yeah.
And most of the methods, another question I'm probably going to be asked today, most of the methods it tacitly use asymptotic statistics.
Yeah.
And when you've got four studies there,
yeah,
any idea of asymptotic is pretty dodgy, isn't it? and I think that's another aspect. The symmetry, we like symmetrical things because the central limit theory tells us about that kind of thing. But we know when you have a small amount of data. So I haven't answered your question
quite directly,
except to say that I'm very cautious about all these things.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. So I think what we'll now do is unmute everybody who's taking part in the call and invite people to ask any questions. We've got a couple up here on the screen that people have typed in. If when you're asking your question you could introduce yourself, I think that would be helpful. And please speak clearly so that everybody can hear you. And you have to type *6 to unmute yourself. Okay. So, is there anyone who'd like to ask a question? I think we're now open for that. Okay, so there's one question that just has come up here on the screen, which is that some of the reasons that lead to a study not being published are not necessarily tied directly to the T ratio, theta over sigma, which I think called Y in the paper. So here it's mentioned the possibility that the researcher involved in the study retired. So it's possible that the selection has an upper bound that's below one. I guess how plausible is this bound? Is this focusing on Y in general? Could you elaborate on that?
Yes. the section is not about lesson one. Now there is an issue actually in the way this is formulated. P equals one, I'm assuming, means there's no bias, but of course doesn't necessarily. So A in my notation, A y equals one for y is, you know, has no bias, and then everything is published. But of course, AY equals a half for Y, that also has no bias. So the constants, you have an indeterminate constant. Yeah. So I sometimes think of that as a two-stage process.
Yeah.
That you first of all take a random sample, imagine a random sample of the population. And then you monkey around with the random to you know, selectively choose things. And the first stage is irrelevant. The second stage is the one that matters. So there may be a misunderstanding in the way I formulated one. So the selection probability must always actually be less than one, because I mean, nobody can possibly measure that you get absolutely everything. And then the thing was, have you studied selection functions, gamma phi, alpha plus beta hat, theta? That just puts a gamma in front,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I think that would make no difference.
Okay.
If the gamma was the same for everybody, because that's just the first stage in the thing I've mentioned. But this just prompts me to point out, if you look into the literature, of course, you have a very wide variety of selection functions, some of which I mentioned in the paper.
There's a question from Ian White. Ian, do you want to ask your question? Okay. So, you know, essentially two sensitivity parameters, beta and P. So in the presentation, in the paper, you fixed P and estimated beta, but you could do it the other way around. Did you do it the way you did it because fixing P is more interpretable, or is there more information in the data about beta than P?
That's a very good question, actually. Beta and P are very highly confounded.
Okay.
Just as in the Preston model, I think I have a comment here. P and, I think actually it was beta in the Preston model. They're very highly confounded. So Preston, in her paper, fixes beta and then fits the whole thing and then estimates beta. So I'm really doing that sort of thing in a way, but for P instead of beta, but I don't do the estimating step. But this is a good question. My guess is the answer is very similar, because P and beta both soak up the juice of this impossibility aspect. But from interpretability, there's no question, surely, that fixing P is the thing. But it's an interesting question. I'll just have a look at the
see what happens.
Profile likelihood for beta.
So if you would like to ask a question, you need to press *6 on your phone to unmute yourself. And very happy to receive any questions. So there's been a recent paper in Statistics and Medicine, I think, which extended the Kokas and Chi method to network meta-analysis, estimating indirect comparisons. What are your views on such developments?
Well, I don't know this paper, so I'm rather hamstrung. As I said before, I mean, a big motivator of this particular one was to try and simplify the Kokas and Chi paper. And the alpha and beta, I mentioned earlier, the Kokas and Chi method is the thing you use for the coordinates of the order of the section sensitivity graphs. Now, that alpha and beta is going to be multidimensional, because you've got different studies. So to understand what happens as you tweak alpha and beta jointly is something you can do in continuity. But how you do that if you have tenuity syndrome otherwise, who knows? So I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that paper, but
my initial view would be one of caution as to whether this is sufficiently utopian to be attractive. But I may be completely wrong, which I'm just going to depend.
Okay, so there's an increasing move in a lot of applied work to individual patient data meta-analysis, where you try and recover the actual underlying studies and individual patient data within those. And then that allows you to model some of the heterogeneity, which marginally might manifest itself as a small study effect. Say, if the patients in certain small studies are more likely to benefit from treatment because they've been selected to enter the study because of their prognosis. I presume that this sensitivity framework can be naturally extended to this case. Do you see any particular issues with that?
I don't think so, except there has to be an analogy why. Yes. Why is a summary statistic, isn't it? And I can't see how you do this sort of thing without having the summary statistic to trigger the selection.
Yeah.
Which in a sense undoes the whole idea of...
Yeah.
But you're right, the real strength is the heterogeneity, isn't it? And I think there's a comment in the paper, I think it's in section 6 somewhere, that allowing for this heterogeneity, this tau parameter, allowing that to depend on the quantity P, does try and model the link,
yeah,
the rather subtle link between selection and heterogeneity. And if you can explain the heterogeneity by essentially covariates, which you can really only do convincingly with individual random data, then I think that is a very big situation for dealing. If this whole thing was fixed effects, it would be even transparently clear as to what's going on.
Okay, so Ian has sent another question, and he says that he also wondered about empirical evidence about publication biases. So Pocock et al. In 2004 have a graph of Z statistics in observational studies showing about 6 times as many with Z just above 1.96 as below it. Is there any useful comparable empirical work to be done in randomized controlled trials?
Well, I think there is quite a bit of actual work going on, isn't
there? I think there is in the book that Alex Sutton edited.
Yes, yes. And the work that Doug Alton has been involved, yeah, in would be very strong in this kind of thing. But to see so many of these studies having a Z statistic just over 1.96, this is rather telling, isn't it? Of exactly the selection.
It's quite an indictment of the scientific enterprise.
Yes. I'm sorry, this is not part of this question, but no, this does prompt the thought that meta-analysis is actually a scientific question. You know, whenever you do a Google search, you know exactly what's, and you only do a Google search because you want to find out something.
Yeah.
And so you're completely lost. Yeah. Sorry, I haven't got any questions.
Okay, so I'd like to... So Ian's just commenting that... That this also supports John's model that the probability of selection depends on a Z statistic, so that's very nice. Mm. And I think that's a good point probably to draw the session to a close. I'd like to thank John once again for a very, very stimulating presentation. Before we go our separate ways, I'd like to say that the next meeting of the Journal Club is scheduled to be in December. The precise date is still to be confirmed, and that's going to be on a recent paper in Series B, Point Processes Modelling for Directed Interaction Networks, by Patrick Perry and Patrick Wolfe from New York University in the United States. I'd like to thank you all very much for joining us at the Journal Club this afternoon. I'd like to thank on your behalf Jack Beebe and Judith Shorten and Martin Owen, who've been hard at work on the other side of the table here, coordinating the technical aspects. I'd like to thank Quintiles for sponsoring the meeting this afternoon. I hope you found the meeting this afternoon useful and stimulating. I'd remind you that you can submit some feedback online, and I'd like to encourage you to spread the word about the Journal Club to colleagues and friends. And on that note, wish you good afternoon.